Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fabulous fireside room, today's speaker is Chuck Huff, and he will be speaking on Conflict, the 18th Camel. So let's listen in on Chuck Huff.
Anthropologist tells, I think, apocryphal story about an Arab who knew that he was going to die soon, and so told his three sons how to divide his estate up. And said to the eldest son that he would get one half of the estate, to the next son that he would get a third of the estate, and to the third son that he would get one ninth of the estate. Well, when the sheikh finally died, turned out that his estate was 17 camels. And his sons wrangled and fought over how to divide these camels up. And while they were raising dust, a wise woman came to them riding her camel and offered to give her camel to them to make it easier for them to solve their dispute. So it turned out that with an addition of one camel, you could do it. Now you have 18. So you have 9 camels. And 6. And 2. Divided up very nicely. And if you add those numbers up that are on the top, you'll see what you come to. So the wise woman got on her camel and rode off into the sunset. Mm-hmm. I think she provides an excellent example of what a third-party mediator can do. I think probably the best thing now is simply to show you my list of the whole variety of things that a third-party mediator can do. Then we can talk about them. The items that... Ooh, you might want to have the screen down. The items that are bulleted are sort of larger level clumpings of things. So as a mediator, you can deal, or if you bring a mediator in, they can help you deal with the physical and social structure of the conflict that you have. They can help you deal with the issue structure, and they can help you deal with people's motivation to resolve the conflict. I like the example of the 18th camel, partly because it's not clear which of these it is she's doing. You could say she was providing additional resources, sort of. You could say that she was helping to restructure the way the issues were being done. And I suspect that she was doing some of these things too, down at the bottom. sort of some work with folks' motivation to resolve the conflict. So I use that example because these kinds of lists are easy to take as, well, let's do this and then this and then this and then this. And what you find is that creative third-party mediators often will do four or five things with a single action. I want to dwell on that thought for a minute. Because I know a lot of you are thinking about situations that you are in that you might be able to go back and help to play some kind of a role in helping people resolve problems. Just like in learning prayer or learning the way of the mystic, the way to learn conflict resolution is to practice it. It doesn't come from reading books, although books are very helpful because they can lay stuff out for you. But what you need to do, in fact, is to practice it regularly. Now, I think that you can do this all of the time rather than simply doing it whenever there's a big fight. You can do it at home. All the kind of steps that we have talked about with regard to being concerned about perceptions, thinking about conflict in a different way, thinking about when it's good to escalate and when it might not be good to escalate, what the problems are. Working on getting to yes, working on problem-solving strategies. All of these can be done, I think, even the small things that we do every day. And you have a chance to be a third-party mediator in that same way, even in small things. And it's getting practice from those that allow you to be able to do it well when the crunch comes. Let me go through some of these really quickly. Most of us were amused at the amount of time it took the negotiators at the end of the Vietnam War to choose the shape of the table. But when tensions are high and issues of face are very important, issues of respect are very important, things like the shape of the table and who walks in first and what your names look like on the name cards can become very, very important issues. Or they can even become stand-ins for other issues. So one of the things that a third-party mediator has to look at are precisely these sort of minutiae of the environment that a conflict is occurring in. One of the things that we were talking about yesterday was the issue of whether communication between the two parties should be face-to-face or whether it should be mediated. By mediated, I mean the two parties actually sit in different rooms and do not see or talk directly to each other, and they only talk to the third party. You see this happen a lot. Not pastors end up doing this. There are times when this is a really useful strategy, particularly when people are so angry that all they would do is beat on each other. What you might be able to do is to work out some of these motivation and issue things early on as a mediator without them having to talk directly to each other. And then when it looks like there's some momentum, when it looks like they might be willing to agree with each other, then bring them together. No surprise, one of the good things with regard to this is to teaching people communication skills, so that in fact they can let the other party know just how upset they are about a particular issue, or just how important a particular issue is to them. We don't think very much about communication with each other. We just sort of do it, and we do it reasonably well, actually. But when the stakes get high and people are angry, we fall back into some of our more primitive modes of communication, like grunting. Determining where folks meet is often important. And it is not always good to choose neutral territory. If, as a mediator, you think that there's a real power imbalance, and that unless that power imbalance is addressed, you're not going to be able to get a solution that both parties will be happy with for a long time, one of the ways that you can help to play with that power imbalance is to meet on the less powerful person's territory. You have to be careful about this, because sometimes they might simply feel like you're invading their territory. But one way to address it is to meet on the less powerful person's territory so they feel at home, and it's the more powerful person, the person with the big desk, who puts it between you and them and leans back, gets a lot of distance. It's the more powerful person who now feels like they're an equal, or more equal. Whether the meetings are open or closed is also an important issue. By open, I mean public. Closed, I mean talks just between the two parties. Jimmy Carter used this, I think, to great effect when he had the Arabs, when he had Egypt and Israel talking together. Early meetings were closed. But as the process of the meetings went on, and as it looked like there was momentum, and it looked like they were agreeing on a lot of basic issues, Carter made much of it public. And once you've made it public, then you're committed to the things that you have said you agree on. One of the problems with making things public early in a negotiation is that, surprise, you're committed. Right? So early stances that you take in a negotiation that you might like to be flexible about, when we were talking about yesterday, you don't have as much of a chance to be flexible about. This is what politicians get caught in all the time, and why there's so many political commercials about Senator so-and-so used to say this, and now says this. They have to take all of their stands in public. So I'm perfectly willing then to see some closed-door meetings among senators if we can in fact get some kind of an agreement out of it. Time limits are also an important issue, and mediators can use them to their advantage. Again, though, you have to be careful. You don't want to just arbitrarily set a time limit. But if it looks like people are beginning to come to a conclusion, and Carter did this again in the Camp David talks, you can then say, I'll only be here for another 3 days, and you've got to decide by then. And they've made all this progress, and they're so close, a public deadline like that makes it more likely that they will try to come to an agreement. You'll note, of course, that all of these things are interacting with each other. That is, this stuff doesn't live alone. I mean, I've been talking about why sites of meetings and why time limits in order to talk about getting momentum. or maintaining momentum. So all of these things interact with each other. One of the things the wise Arab woman did was provide additional resources. In an odd sort of way, she then got them back. But very often, third parties can provide additional resources to help things. The United States does this all the time, and that's why they have a foreign aid budget. Because they can provide additional resources to people, to disputants, to nations, in order to make it easier to come to an agreement. One of the dangers with this kind of provision of additional resources is this thing at the bottom. Things that third parties can't provide, which is solutions to all of the problems. You don't want nations or brothers and sisters to get used to a third party bringing in additional resources to bail out their inability to agree. So if mama always comes in and gives extra money in order to sell the fight, pretty soon the children figure that one out. They say, ooh, we can get more ice cream this way. Let's have another fight. One of the things we talked about earlier that is important for people to do as they think about their own negotiating strategy is to think about their own issues that are important to them and the underlying interests that make those issues important. And that's what I mean by issue identification. That is to help other parties think carefully through what it is that's important to them in this particular fight. Instruction in the nature of conflict is useful, particularly with regard to issues. Because remember, as we talked a couple of days ago about escalation, the transformations that occur during escalation, one of the transformations is that you bring more and more and more issues in. And you bring more and more and more people in. And the issues become more grandiose. So that if you talk to people about these very kinds of transformations, it's at least possible for them to see that they may be heading down the wrong trail with the kinds of claims that they're making. Issue packaging, by which I mean putting two or more issues together, and the sequencing of issues is very important. It's no surprise, since I've been talking about momentum, that what you want to do is to get some agreement on some issues early on. So if you've got things that are easy to agree on, don't save them for later. Don't save them for cleanup. Try to get those issues resolved early. Partly because that helps to encourage trust. And people say, oh, we can't agree on something. You can also, with regard to sequencing, try to get people to agree on basic interests early on. This is, I think, what Paul is doing. Actually, I shouldn't say I think. Christine is here. This is what Christine thinks Paul is doing. I'll cite my authority. In Romans, when he's saying, no, look, your very basic interests are that you're all part of the church. And let's all agree on that first before we talk about these other issues. And if you can do that, it can create a kind of momentum, because you can say, ah, see, we've agreed on something. It can also encourage trust. It can do a lot of these other motivation things if you can get people early on to commit themselves to an agreement with each other. Introduction of new issues may be important, particularly because of what we were talking about earlier. I see that hand. I feel like a revival preacher. When we say that, when we said that some integrative agreements involve trading things off. Well, if you're going to trade stuff off, maybe what you need to do is to bring another issue in to trade on. Yes?
When you talk about deciding the issues, I think when I look back on where there's confrontation and stuff, in order to get people to decide on these things, it almost sounds like there needs to be a kind of formal sitting down and maybe stating that you, what are the things we agree on? I mean, somebody to just just to say in a bunch of where Christians are involved, if you say, I can see people saying, well, we're all Christian here. And that just sort of goes over your head.
Right.
But if you could somehow make that part of what you're talking about, I mean, you need to have a specific technique.
Yeah, well, and this, I think, is why Paul's letter to the Romans is so long. Because he's not doesn't simply say, well, we're all Christians. He goes into great detail about how we are all justified together. To make sure that we have thought very carefully about the connections. And I think you're right. You can't simply just say that. The one reason, I'm a little afraid of what you said is that you said formal.
Well,
I'm not sure that I agree that it always has to be formal. Sometimes it can be formal. And making it formal may be useful for people, for instance, in a church to sit down and draft a document of the things they all agree about. But it may also simply be useful for them to come regularly to a Bible study and study the things they all agree about. Which is another way of emphasizing agreement between people and saying, this is a Bible study where we agree. Instead of, this is a Bible study where we'll fight. Well, I promise we'll have a Bible study where we'll fight later. Right now, let's have one where we agree. So I don't think it has to be formal, but I think you're very correct that it has to be careful, intentional, and taken very seriously. Yes, sir? I thought you had your hand.
Me?
Yes.
No.
Oh, okay. It's like an auction. If you move, you're in trouble.
Sure.
One of the things that people often forget about in conflicts is face saving. Face, I think, is a wonderful word. It's not psycho jargon. We use it all the time. But I like it because it suggests face-to-face with a person and being able to look at them and to hold your head up. Suggests the kind of respect that we want to receive from others. And when we get involved in conflicts, we often get very caught up in issues of blame. So we want to make sure that the guilty are punished. Sometimes making sure that the guilty are punished is going to guarantee a loss of face on the part of the guilty side. And it's also then going to guarantee that they are not going to have trust in you. Because it's clear then to that person that you're more interested in blaming them than in working with them. So one of the hard things to do in conflict resolution is to get people away from issues of blaming the guilty, punishing the guilty, and get people thinking about an agreement that both parties can walk away from with respect. One of the fascinating things to me about legal proceedings, this happens particularly in divorce, but it happens in a lot of others, is that very often they stop becoming about who gets what resources and are easily transformed into who's to blame for what and I'm going to make you pay. So lawyers end up sort of getting court fees so that their clients can have this emotional therapy of being able to blame the other person. Although they may spend all of the money they might have made, they feel better because, by God, the guilty have been punished. So this is, I think, really a central issue, this thing of face saving. And it's a thing that we so often forget in conflicts when things get hot and heavy. We've been talking really all week about trust. Being able to trust the other party. There's a variety of moves that third party mediators can make. And they can use the, and we talked about them last time with regard to how to move from conflict to negotiated settlement in terms of making small concessions, getting each party to do that for the other, all of these sorts of things you can do as a third party mediator in order to get people to the point where they're willing then to negotiate. We talked about diffusing emotions yesterday. About letting people talk about their anger and how at times it's useful, but at times it simply becomes a rehearsing of all the ills that have been done and it makes the anger worse. This is a thing that you simply have to be careful about yourself as you are thinking about what the outcome might be of doing that. I've been doing momentum all the way down. Another issue that is really important, particularly with third-party mediators, is the issue of the autonomy of the people who are in the dispute. In fact, you can find agreement between two parties simply by saying, in a week, we'll get a mediator. And they say, we'll solve it ourselves. And that's what I mean by this need for autonomy. They want to say, we solved it. We didn't have to have somebody from the outside come in. And this is a problem for some third parties because it's nice to come in and be the white knight on a horse. But think of the problem. If as a third party you come in and you solve their problem with all of your skills and then you leave. Well, here you have people who have not been educated in how to resolve their conflicts, but have simply had one conflict resolved for them. So what you need to do as a third party is not only to get a solution that the parties that you're trying to help can all live with, but help them learn how to do it again without you. Third parties are not a guarantee. Surprise, I've been saying nothing is a guarantee. Third parties aren't a guarantee of some kind of a resolution. They can be helpful, particularly when distrust is and suspicion is high. But if it is really high and if people have their heels dug in, there are times when the best thing that the third party can do is threaten to leave. And say, I'm out of here. It's clear that y'all would rather fight. And there's nothing I can do to help. Yes?
I think of conflicts that are truly resolved. It seems there's an element of confession, either private or public. I wonder...
Could you unpack that? It's what you're saying sounds fascinating, and I'd like to hear more.
Thinking of a spouse conflict, for example, it's not really fixed and moved on until there's some realization. I think on both sides, it says, "Oh, whoops." And whether that's talked about or not, either or, but I wonder what role confession, what role that plays with a third party.
Yeah. You know, I can talk about it in a psychological sense. I'm not sure that I can do it in a spiritual sense about what confession does for you. I mean, I could mumble some words, but I haven't thought carefully about it in a spiritual sense. Apologies are great things. And in fact, let's get back to this issue of face. When you have a conflict between all the other person wants, they're willing to give up whatever it is that the fight was over. But all they want is to save their face, be respected in the relationship, and an apology can go a long, long ways towards doing that. Partly because apologies are admissions of guilt, but partly also because apologies are at least implicit promises of future good behavior. We feel funny about someone who apologizes and then goes out and does it again. Yes?
Well, what you're talking about reminds me of our very wise preschool and kindergarten teacher. These 4 and 5-year-olds aren't allowed to say, I'm sorry. They have to look at the other child and say, will you forgive me? And the other child has to respond. And we certainly see a very minimal amount of confidence among these small children.
I like that. Because particularly with children, but you know, we're all children at times, more so when we get in conflicts. It's very easy to say, I'm sorry. About as pro forma as you can get, that I'm sorry. And it's clear that although the words are there, the nonverbal signals are, I'm really not sorry, but she made me say it. But to ask for forgiveness really is to put yourself in a relationship with that other person. And then to depend on that other person to validate the relationship that you have. And that's a very different kind of thing than simply saying, I'm sorry. In fact, apologies feel odd if they're not accepted. And it's the acceptance of an apology that has usually at least implicit forgiveness in it. And then what you've done with that apology is that you have saved face on both sides. You see how it works, that both sides save face? Even the person who apologizes has the other person say, yes, and we're still connected. Well, I forgive you. You now have face for me.
And when you say to somebody, well, I'm sorry, or I apologize, I've done this and I've done this and I wish I hadn't, I would think that, well, I would respond, oh, I'm sorry too, I shouldn't have done such and such, so that you get other people apologizing.
Yes, I mean, there often is, there is in fact a norm in our society of reciprocity. Right, so that if I do a thing for you, you feel obligated to do a thing for me, and Hallmark cards makes lots of money on this. And that works with apologies. It works, by the way, If you're attempting to get to know someone, now I know I'll sound sneaky, but I don't mean to, with self-disclosure. If I disclose to you, there is a norm of reciprocity that you will disclose to me. And that's how we get to know each other. But I worry some about this issue of reciprocity. Because it can be manipulative. That is, I can say, yeah, let's say I'm in the wrong, and Christine knows I'm in the wrong. I didn't go to her Bible study. I promised her I would.
He's lying. Are you calling him a liar?
Okay, we can go with that one too. I might apologize to her in a way that asks her to apologize to me when she really has done nothing wrong. And you have to be very careful in those kinds of circumstances. Because, again, there's this issue of face between the two parties. And I'm being manipulative, and Chris, and what is she going to say? I'm sorry I didn't move the time of the Bible study so you could come. And we often get these sort of pro forma apologies in return, when really the person doesn't have anything to apologize for, and they can feel very manipulated into giving an apology. By the way, I wish we could do this better in the United States with corporations. Well, the Japanese are just great at this. Presidents of corporations, when a product of theirs is faulty, will write letters of apology to people who were harmed and will resign. And in that society, that's not thought of then as a flag run up the pole saying, all lawyers come here and make money. Whereas in our society, an apology is an admission of guilt that we could then take advantage of. I think it would make it easier for companies to apologize if we weren't such a suit-happy society. Now, I don't know how to get us out of this chicken and egg problem. I'm just musing now. Because, of course, we can't just not sue folks. This is why you will often find companies say things like, yes, we've made a recall of the product, but we take no responsibility. Now, there wasn't a problem with the car, but we're going to recall it and fix it. Because they don't want to make this formal admission of guilt, which then would open them wide up. And we often find that, even in interpersonal relationships in our society, and I think it can do real damage to our relationships, people who are unwilling to admit guilt. I think part of the reason people are unwilling to admit guilt is because they are unsure that they will receive forgiveness. That they think that all they'll get is slapped about a bit. I'm saying these things partly because, you know, I have done a fair amount of, I've done research and apologies and stuff. But right now I'm just talking on feeling based on the kind of, we've collected thousands of apologies from students and looked at the ways different people apologize to others and how people give forgiveness, etc. And a lot of the things that I'm talking about I don't have sort of clear direct evidence on, but I'm talking just based on a feel. Whenever I play psychologist, I want to make sure that I let you know when I'm doing one versus saying I got lots of data to suggest this is true. Yes?
Are there some characteristics or personal qualities that a good third party mediator needs? To be successful.
It's unclear to me that personality characteristics are that important. Obviously you don't want to have the social skills of a porcupine. There are some things you want to not have. You probably also don't want to have the social skills of a piece of slate, which is not sort of actively offensive like a porcupine, but still sort of hard to talk to. I think people with a wide variety of personality characteristics, if they practice and if they are thoughtful, can do third-party mediation in their own style. So I don't think there's a particular excellent style for third-party mediators, just like there is no single excellent teacher. Teacher styles differ a great deal, partly depending upon their personality, but they can all be thought of as excellent teachers. If there's anything, perhaps two P's, patience and persistence. Because third-party mediation can be long, involved, deadly stuff. And third-party mediators need to be able to persevere so that they can get through the wall. But again, you got to balance that because you don't want to stay there all day. Yeah.
Yeah, I find when I'm involved in mediating in the university and society that is it surrounds the university, it's like chess. With patience, sometimes you have to be aggressive, sometimes you have to sort of take a stand back, sometimes you have to play one side, sometimes you have to play the other side. And you just have to look at the whole scheme of things, not just narrow your attentions to one individual within that group, because there's always character conflict, I find, in that saving face aspect. But if you can step aside from that and just play the tactics and keep the goals in sight, you'll get there eventually.
One of the things that you've said strikes me as particularly true, which is the base of why I was saying I don't really think of any personal characteristics of third-party mediators, which is that sometimes third-party mediators have to be aggressive, and sometimes third-party mediators have to be patient. And it all depends upon the situation. So that you don't want a person who's always aggressive to be a third-party mediator because there may be situations that call for a different kind of approach. So what you're saying suggests, I think, a better way which is that if there is a characteristic, it probably has to be flexibility and adaptability of style.
It seemed to me you'd have to be a very good listener.
Yeah.
You have to hear what.
But I'm not sure that being a good listener is a personality characteristic. Yeah. I think being a good listener is a skill that we can all learn regardless of the kind of personality traits that we have. And there are, in fact, there are, in fact, training sessions for being listeners. Perhaps being a creative person. But I'm not sure that creativity is a personality characteristic. I mean, we seem to think it is in our society. But if you talk to most people who are creative, they say that their creativity is the result of just a great deal of sweat and work and intimate familiarity with the issues in the area. So I think people who are willing to work hard can come up with creative solutions if they are willing to be flexible. Yes, sir?
Edison said that invention was 1%
yes.
inspiration and 99% perspiration.
That's right. That's right. And I think that's a good way to think about the sort of being this creativity and problem solving that comes with negotiating, whether you're doing it yourself or whether you're doing it as a third party, which is that you don't have to think of yourself as a creative person. What you do have to think of yourself as is someone who's persistent. How many different filaments did Edison have his assistants try?
1,000. I get a little chagrined when I see real good meeting facilitators or professional negotiators or mediators come to me and say, well, you know, my job is not really hard. Every deal's different, I create in my own mind possible scenarios and solutions. And then I find out the truth is they've got books, libraries of books with lots of different examples.
They spend lots of time sweating.
And so they really aren't just creating it out of nothing. They're creating it out of a great deal of background. Yeah.
This is a problem, I think, in general in the United States with regard to the way we think about skill. And it's why we have trouble getting kids to learn mathematics, for instance. We think of mathematics as a skill either you got or you don't. Other cultures think of ability with mathematics as something that you get by working hard at it. And it is not simply that you're a math whiz, that there's some part of your brain that some of us get and others don't. Like a math co-processor. But in our culture, we want to believe that these abilities are some kind of an occult gift that folks have. And we have a very popular mythology about that. Part of it, I think, is a desire to get all the credit for doing it. So when your colleagues who do mediation say, well, you know, I just kind of think these things up, what they're really saying is, gosh, I'm smart and good and you should respect me. And we don't respect as much people who work really hard in order to get a particular outcome. So that leads us in our culture to hide our work and emphasize this occult skill that we have with math or with mediation. Or again, that's another reason why I'm kind of unwilling to say that there are a lot of personality characteristics that are good for third-party mediators. I think if you want to be a third-party mediator, the primary thing that you have to be good at is working. You have to be willing to really immerse yourself in the issues. Yes?
There was a term somewhere along in my experience that was used, an enabler.
Mm-hmm.
Is that at all like what you're talking about?
Well, that's precisely what a lot of these kinds of things that I'm talking about are. You help people come up with their own solutions. And that's what I was saying earlier about this issue with autonomy. You don't want to come in as a third party, solve their problems, and then ride off into the sunset. That's the one thing, actually, I don't like about the 18th Camel story. What you want to do instead is to work with the parties to enable them to solve their own problems. Partly because then they can do it later, and partly because in a sort of odd twist of psychology, if you can get them to think they did it instead of you, they're going to be more committed to it. I think some of the best teachers are teachers whose students think they did all the work. Because the teachers work hard and set the situation up and enable the student to learn. Yes?
A related subject I don't think that you've touched on in these conflict resolution sessions that I think is important, particularly I think of labor negotiations or maybe what the State Department negotiators have to do. Many times the participants are not completely the deciders. They are a representative of a constituency.
Yes.
You've got 4 minutes. How do you handle that?
One of the problems with representatives of a constituency is that representatives are much more likely to dig their heels in than are people who are not representatives. Because if you're, this is why we see deadlock in Congress, because they have to go back to their constituents and explain precisely why they gave the store away, or at least which section of the store they gave away. One of the things I think that you can do when you have people who are representatives of parties is to attempt to insulate them from this sort of immediate and micro accountability.
The camera in the negotiating room.
That's right, the camera in the negotiating room. This is why Jimmy Carter had early on closed meetings between Sadat and Begin, because he didn't want them to have to account in the newspapers every day for everything they talked about. So you need to provide some kind of insulation. We do this, by the way, in our U.S. government. The Senate doesn't have to get elected as often. So it provides a kind of insulation for them to be able to horse trade more than representatives who have to get elected pretty often.
Is the open meeting law a problem in our country as you see it?
Oh boy, isn't that a good question? Yes and no. I mean, I think it's a necessary thing, because I think we've had too much happening in... If I trusted people, I'd say let them meet behind closed doors. The problem is that I don't trust folks, particularly folks who are in power. This is why I think the stroke of genius of the folks who put together our government was to have this balancing of different powers against each other, so that you didn't have to trust one, you just had to trust that they would all not trust each other. Yes?
When you talked about the Korean War and stuff, and you talked about the time spent on the table, the size and shape of the table, are you saying then that we should see this, not sit back and just be cynical and say, oh, how ineffective and what a waste of time, but maybe recognize that real skills are going on here?
I think that's true. It's also possible to use the shape of the table as simply a stalling tactic. So it's not all the time that it's that it's useful. But very often, issues of face and issues of power are central in terms of setting up a negotiation. And if a group of people feels like they are do not have as much power when they're negotiating with another group, to put them at the head of the table is really to change the power dynamic in the conversation.
So maybe our government does know some things that they're doing.
I think so.
What a shame.
It'd be nice to think.
We don't hear that because we just read.
Well, it's hard to report it well. And I also see now we're back to stereotypes of news reporters, which we were doing earlier this week. It's also, I think, the case that news reporters are more interested in reporting these things as horse races instead of as careful attempts to balance interests. You know, so they report on, for instance, the medical, the healthcare bills simply as horse racing instead of trying to give us a feeling for all of the balancing and competing interests that are going on in the healthcare bills so that we can see the kind of moves that people make. And if they report it as a horse race, well then, that's the way we talk to our senators and our representatives and say, by God, you better win. Instead of, by God, you better get us our basic interests. Well, we are out of time. And I have to go make my bed before I get on the bus. Thank you.